This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A blockbuster movie requires blockbuster marketing, and marketing strategies are now affecting what movies get made, how they're made, and where they're shown. My guests, Dade Hayes and Jonathan Bing, spent several years chronicling the film business for Variety, where they're now editors. Hayes and Bing have written a new book called Open Wide: How Hollywood Box Office Became a National Obsession. The book examines how big-budget movies are marketed by focusing on three that opened last year on July 4th weekend, Terminator 3, Legally Blonde 2, and the animated film Sinbad. A lot of your book is about the pursuit of getting a big opening weekend box office. And, of course, on July 4th, since it's summer vacation and a holiday, a lot of people are available to go to the movies, so you could get a particularly big opening weekend if you're lucky. Why is there such a big emphasis in Hollywood on having a big opening weekend? What does it matter?
Well, one of the most important reasons for this fetish for opening weekend, is that films have such short shelf lives, especially the big blockbusters that are the subject of the book. I read in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago that Oliver Stone said that he'd worked for 3 years on the movie Alexander, and it was over in 3 weeks. These films come along and they have a wide opening. They open in thousands of theaters around the country. And within a few weeks, the world's forgotten about them. And they're on to the DVD.
And the number becomes a sales tool. You know, the number becomes a commodity that you can actually promote. That's what's happened in the last 20, 25 years, is that Spider-Man does $114 million in its first 3 days, the original film. And that becomes the event. That becomes the thing that people want to participate in. And it plugs right into this fascination with batting averages and stock quotes and, all these kind of bits of essentially trivia. But it kind of commodifies the movie-going experience in a way that people can understand and that the marketers can, try to deliver on that level.
If you want to get a big gross on the opening weekend, you have to open in as many theaters as possible, or open wide, as the expression is and as the title of your book goes. And opening wide has a new meaning now that there's megaplexes that have, 15 or 30 theaters in one complex. So how has the existence of megaplexes changed how films open and what the meaning of opening wide is?
Well, we chronicle in the book this phenomenon that came to be called the rescreening of America, in which giant megaplexes, and a megaplex is defined technically in the trade as a theater with more than 16 screens, were built across the American suburbs. And we focus on one suburb in particular, Ontario, California, which is about a half an hour's drive outside of LA, where there are two megaplexes next to each other, one with 30 screens, one with 22 screens. And at the height of the summer, blockbuster season, there's really nothing but blockbusters playing on these 52 screens. You won't find a single independent or quote-unquote art house film playing in this theater, and in either of those theaters. And so in a very direct way, it's limited the choices of American moviegoers.
That's so counterintuitive. You'd think 52 theaters in one little area, well, we'd be able to see everything in those theaters. So how come it has the reverse effect?
Well, it's kind of down to media consolidation. It's the same battle that's happening on cable television where, it's the old line about, 100 channels and nothing's on, because all the same conglomerates are controlling those vertical revenue streams. And so, you have this cluster of theater companies that dominate the landscape. About five circuits own 85% of all movie screens in America. And it's about convenience, which is an interesting aspect to this. It's part of, just plugging this whole theater thing into the retail infrastructure and being able to offer showtimes every 10, 15 minutes so that, once you're kind of in that cocoon of shopping and eating and consuming, you then are you'll be able to just sidle up to the line and buy a ticket anytime you want to see a movie.
And Terry, I thought it was important to add that it's really, opening wide is really the name of the game. And this year, films were opening wider and wider. In our book, we chronicle the global release of the third Matrix film, which was released on something like 18,000 prints around the world. And in a kind of curious publicity stunt, they released it at exactly the same fixed moment in time in every territory around the globe. This past summer, There were films like Shrek 2, which opened in 4,000 movie theaters, an unprecedented sort of level of saturation for Hollywood.
This campaign for Matrix Revolutions of opening simultaneously at the exact same second in movie theaters around the globe was actually very effective. What was the thinking behind it?
Well, it was trying to create a publicity gambit, a gimmick, you know, that, and that goes back to the very origins, you know, of these showman producers, you know, guys like Joseph E. Levine that we talk about in the book. He was the impresario and the marketing genius, really, behind movies like Hercules and Godzilla, where you kind of create this spectacle. And who cares, you know, how decent the movie really is, as long as you just pack the theaters in those very opening show times. And that was really all it was. They kind of knew what they had on their hands. They decided to stage this, you know, incredible spectacle. And the global marketplace, which is something we only gesture to because there's just not room for it, but it really has matured pretty dramatically. I mean, territories like Russia, Indonesia, places that you would never even think have 20-screen movie theaters, just like we do here in the suburbs in America. So that's another growth area that also played into the Matrix opening.
And I'll just add that it's a dirty little secret of the movie business that if you open a film in thousands of theaters simultaneously, chances are that you can generate a lot of money quickly before word gets out just how bad the film is. And with that third Matrix film, the reviews were just awful. But within the first 3 days, the film had generated practically $200 million around the world. So, you know, the smell can't really get out quickly enough when the film is opening everywhere simultaneously and there's just a mad rush to see it on opening night.
In your new book, you follow three films, Terminator 3, Legally Blonde 2, and the animated film Sinbad. So two of those films are sequels, Terminator 3 and Legally Blonde 2. Why are sequels so potentially lucrative?
They can be repeated again and again and again over various platforms, video games, toys, DVDs. They're doing direct-to-video DVD sales that would just blow your mind in animation. Some suggested that Sinbad should have gone direct-to-video. It would have made a lot more money. It's just an amazingly kind of systematized, industrialized process that fits perfectly into the MBA kind of models of the conglomerates running the studios. They want widgets. They want, you know, parts that they can stamp out again and again and again. And sure, they understand that the movie business isn't for the faint of heart, but they also want to inject some predictability and some kind of familiarity into the process. And they've also kind of helped cultivate this culture, if you think about the movies that have worked recently, comic book movies and, you know, fantasy epics and so forth, where there is a kind of serial appetite, and you could argue whether that's sort of, you know, nature or nurture, but I think many moviegoers have come to expect other installments and future installments. Certainly we all regret some of the sequels that have been made, but there's now a real drive, a real business incentive behind sequels.
Well, let's look at Legally Blonde 2 for a second. This is one of the films that was focus grouped. It was screened for people who then rated the movie and said what they did and didn't like about it. What are some of the most important things that came out of listening to the focus group?
Well, one was this inherent problem with Elle Woods, who's the character played by Reese Witherspoon. You know, she was the perky sorority girl from the original film. Now she's going to Washington. And how do you invite people in to the world of Washington without completely, you know, flying over their heads or just dumbing it all down? And basically what they decided to do is excise politics entirely from a film that was set in Washington, D.C., in which the lead character, you know, works for a congresswoman. It was just a remarkable stripping away of every term, every scene, every, you know, indication of something that reeked of social studies. That was what the audiences were saying, you know, don't give me that stuff. I want to see her, you know, having a manicure. I want to see, you know, the kind of the pleasure trip that the first movie was.
Sure, the teenage girls in the focus groups for Legally Blonde 2 wanted to see Elle Woods shopping. They wanted to see her chihuahua. They wanted to see her doing her sorority dances. They didn't want to hear about filibusters and political action committees.
I'm going to ask you to choose one of the three films that you write about in your new book, Open Wide, and tell us about what the trailer was and how it was, how the trailer itself was promoted and whether it was effective.
Sure. Let's talk about Sinbad. Sinbad was the animated film from DreamWorks that was a big disaster. It just, no one really knew what Sinbad was. It the advertising campaign didn't manage to really strike a chord with the wide audience. And the last, but there's extensive market research done in the preparation of the marketing campaign and in the last few months of post-production on the film. And one bit of intelligence that was coming back from test screenings was that the audience liked this character of Sinbad's dog. Sinbad, of course, is a character from the Arabian Nights that ironically was, you know, this the film came out shortly after the invasion of Iraq, and in the Arabian Nights, Sinbad is actually a sailor from Baghdad who sets out from the port of Basra. None of that was very good marketing material for the film, and really, that wasn't the film itself was sort of cobbled together from a lot of myths, including the myth of Sinbad. But there was this character of Sinbad's dog Spike, which was invented wholesale by the filmmakers, and the and he tested really well. All the audiences really like Spike. So in the last few months of post-production, Spike became a much bigger character, and he became a very prominent character in the trailers. So the last trailer of for Sinbad that went out featured Spike extensively. And the whole idea of this trailer was to try to make Sinbad seem cool. And the trailer sort of started as if it were like a Mountain Dew commercial. It had Sinbad with the voice of Brad Pitt saying something like, "Who's bad? Sinbad." And they showed the Sinbad ship sort of skittering across an ocean wave as if it was, you know, a scene from sort of an extreme sports surfing competition. And the whole idea was to make Sinbad seem hip with lots of scenes of this dog, Spike. And it didn't really work.
So let's look at what happened with the three movies that you followed, Terminator 3, Legally Blonde 2, and the animated film Sinbad. Were they financial or critical successes?
Kind of all over the map. I mean, Terminator 3 was actually a critically successful movie. Most critics seemed to get on board with it. Commercially, it did okay, but not great in the U.S., but made a great deal of money overseas, about $450 million worldwide, of which only $150 was in the U.S. Legally Blonde 2, not as successful as the first Legally Blonde, but solidly profitable, made about $90 million in ticket sales in the U.S., and is going to sell a lot of DVDs. Sinbad was an unqualified disaster. The losses are estimated at $100 million for DreamWorks. They just sank so much money into the hundreds of people animating the movie and then, of course, in the kind of ill-fated marketing efforts.
So what was the moral of the story for DreamWorks when Sinbad failed at the box office?
They ended up returning to their roots. They bounced back in 2004 with Shrek 2 and with Shark Tale, both computer animated, kind of ultra slick, edgy, kind of edgy for animated movies, fair. And they just didn't even ever look back. They sort of closed the door on the traditional hand-drawn animation, and they're just looking forward into the future. They've spun off DreamWorks Animation as a separately controlled company, and they're just going to keep, you know, cranking out one or two computer animated films a year.
Studios don't like moviegoers to know how much research is going into a movie and how it's focus grouped. You describe it as a pretty secretive process. How much of it did you have access to, and how did you get that access?
Well, it was a slow, gradual process of trying to beat down the doors of the marketing executives and get them to disclose to us the full complexity of the market research process. And it took a while, and some of the events in the book are reconstructed after the fact. But we were surprised at the level to at which we were able to get access to these events, reading the transcripts, listening to the tapes of focus groups, and actually hanging out in the trailer houses where, you know, the trailers were produced. And it actually was easier than we thought. But I think, you know, what was so important to us was to prove to all of the executives that we weren't going to go away, that, you know, that this book was going to be written with or without their cooperation, and that the only chance they had of really, you know, getting the full story across was to cooperate with us and to give us, you know, as much access as possible to, you know, the market research numbers and the process.
John Gregory Dunn's book, The Studio, we talked about before we embarked on this project, and we both agreed, you know, that kind of access in which, you know, in the late 60s, he basically roamed the Fox lot, shadowing the production executives through an entire year's worth of production. It's an impossible book to write nowadays, just because of the corporate control and the kind of paranoia that grips each of these companies. They don't exactly invite you onto the lot for a chat.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Terry.
Dade Hayes and Jonathan Bing are editors at Variety. Their new book is called Open Wide.